everyone. Thank you for attending tonight's Committee of the Whole, District 90.
Are we on? There we go.
Thank you all for coming this evening. My name is Rich Moore, Vice President here in District 90, father of three, one at Lincoln, one at Roosevelt, one at OPRF, and tonight's presentation on technology and social media is one that hits home for me, and thank you all for coming this evening. I'd like to get the call the meeting to order with a roll call.
Sure. Mr. Davis.
Here.
Mrs. DeGracias.
Here.
Mrs. Hickey.
Here.
Mr. Martiri is not here. Mr. Moore.
Here.
Dr. Thompson is not here. Ms. Williams.
Here.
At this time of our meeting, we usually recognize visitors and anybody that wants to make a public comment. We do have one person signed up. As this is intended to be a town hall forum where people can, we will interact later in the or throughout the presentation. Ms. Christy Smith, did you want to make a public comment, or is that just...
I signed on the
okay.
Wow. It's been known to happen.
Okay. With that said, we would like to move to approve the agenda for this evening.
So moved.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGracias?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Okay, that's easy. The next item on our agenda is to approve the final 2018-19 school calendar, which we all had ample time to review. Are there any questions or issues about the calendar? Can I have a motion to approve the calendar?
Second.
Okay.
Stacy was.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGracias?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
Okay, moving on. The Personnel Committee, which I'm chair, presents the personnel report and the approval of mid-year salary advancements that we all also have a chance to look at. If there are any questions that we need to approve the mid-year salary advancement.
Motion to approve.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGracias?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Okay, and on to the main event. I would like to introduce Ms. Judy DeGracias to kick off our I Screen, You Screen, We All Screen presentation.
On behalf of District 90, it's an honor to introduce tonight's keynote speakers. Dr. Rebecca Unger is a general pediatrician with a special interest in nutrition, obesity prevention, and intervention and family fitness. She has been with the Northwestern Children's Practice for over 25 years and also works at Lurie Children's Hospital's Wellness and Weight Management. She's an associate professor of clinical pediatrics at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. She enjoys working with families from prenatal visits through the adolescent years to develop healthy habits. Dr. Unger has enjoyed raising her children and learning from both of them every step of the way. In addition to her active work and family life, Dr. Unger can frequently be found playing her banjo at local farmers markets, dancing, and practicing yoga. Dr. Scott Goldstein, also a general pediatrician, has been with the Northwestern Children's Practice since 2003. He has a special interest in parent education and is an instructor of clinical pediatrics at Northwestern University School of Medicine. He has spoken to numerous parent groups as well as to local and national media on a variety of topics, including immunizations, nutrition, behavior, and sleep. Originally from Maryland, Dr. Goldstein attended college at Northwestern University, received his medical degree with honors from the University of Illinois, and completed his pediatric residency at Brown University. He and his family live in River Forest, and he's an avid reader as well as a comedy and Bruce Springsteen enthusiast. shared goal this evening is to empower the community with information on this topic. Dr. Unger and Dr. Goldstein, we welcome you to District 90, and thank you for being here tonight.
I'll probably be okay just talking, I think.
It'll be here if you need it.
People I know here makes me a little nervous. There's a big difference between Scott Goldstein, the pediatrician, and Scott Goldstein, the River Forest dad. So for anybody who's friends with me on Facebook out here, it's a little different than what you typically see. So, and also I'm glad to see everybody made it here safely. One day without a police bulletin. So far, the night is young. Let's see if we can get the slides. So the title of the talk is I Screen, You Screen, We All Screen. And like Judy said in the beginning, Dr. Unger and I have been in practice for combined about close to 50 years or so. The title of this wouldn't have made any sense to us until a few years ago, even though most five-year-olds would know what we're talking about now. Just before we start, because we have a lot to go through, are there people here who have, I know there's elementary and middle and high school parents. Are there any parents of kids like 5 and under? Okay, perfect, because I don't want to leave anything out. So.
Our pilot
slide is
so cool.
Oh, yeah, I know. Okay.
Of course.
I was thinking about it.
Well, while it's warming up, I'll tell you what our goal is. Okay, perfect. We just like the title so much, we had to show it. So we were for a long time on that. And then we could probably turn the lights down here. Oh, perfect. Now it's coming up. So. Okay, so what we want to do tonight is talk about the current recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics about media use. And we're going to talk about common media-related concerns from birth through high school. Give you some quality resources and hopefully answer specific questions that you have. Media is something that is, I don't know what that is up there, but it's constantly in the news every day. This is just from, one of these articles is just from today about this Facebook Messenger Kids app. This is a screen time quiz on NPR from a couple days ago. I just pulled some headlines from since the beginning of the year, since January. And most of the messages that we get from the from media, about media, is not always good and often contradictory. So here we see media is making our kids tired and violent. It's affecting kids' safety. There's an article about violent and aggressive behavior. We need to ban social media. Children are facing significant emotional risk on social media. But we should also teach kids how to use social media and not scare them away from it. It's the media company's fault. Attempts to pull children ever deeper into the world of social media should concern us all. But Apple says, no, they've always looked out for kids, and Facebook is saying that today, too. Whose fault is it? It's our fault. It's parents' fault. You want to know why children are addicted to social media? Blame the parents. But what are we supposed to do? This article says if you want to take your kid's cell phone away, probably not a good idea. You don't want to discipline them by actually taking it away. And no matter what we do, kids are going to eat laundry pods, so we're kind of fighting against that. So before I get into like the nitty-gritty of the recommendations and all the things that can kind of be scary about media, I want to share this quote that I like from the author, Elizabeth Gilbert. And everything that's in this quote is backed by research. It's all true. All surveys and studies on teenagers go for these facts. So today's American teenagers are the most sensitive, least violent, least bullying, least racist, least homophobic, most globally minded, most compassionate, most environmentally conscious, least dogmatic, and overall kindest group of young people this country has ever known. So, let's see how we're messing them up. Where do we stand? This is when I was growing up in the 80s. This is all there was. You were lucky if you had one of these, maybe an Atari, an Apple II. When Dr. Unger was growing up, this was her home computer.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you.
Some people may know this guy. If you have an iPhone, get it out and start walking through these steps here. This is one of my kids who goes to school here. And anybody who knows him will know that he is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But this is something he showed me, and he gave me permission to say that. He showed me this on his phone. If you have your iPhone out, take a second to go through this, if you don't already know it. I didn't know it.
Does anyone know it? Has anyone ever done this before?
Did you do it? His lead into this is, I can tell you where you've been. Anybody got in there yet?
It's different on Android.
Yeah, Android. Yeah, we can't deal with Android.
Can you do an Android version?
I don't know anything about Android. this is only for iPhones. It basically will show you everywhere you've been, how long you've spent there, when you were there, how long ago. It's kind of scary, right? So he is what we call a digital native, meaning that iPhones and tablets and texting and virtual reality were all pretty much part of his life for as long as he can remember. Meanwhile, we've had technology developing literally in the blink of an eye. There's the title of this, Augenblick, which is, my wife is from Germany. She was going to be here, but we had a dog-related issue tonight. Augenblick is one of the three German words that I actually think sound better than the English. It means blink of an eye. The other, Schadenfreude, everybody likes that. And does anybody know what you call like a bag that you carry your toiletries in German? It's called a Waschnecessaire. It's such a cool word. It's better than toilet stuff bag. The development of technology is accelerating faster than we can imagine, pretty much in the blink of an eye. You can see this timeline of communication tools. The earliest form of communication started about 5,000 years ago. That's like papyrus and drums. Paper about 2,000 years ago. Telephones about 160 years ago. TV 90 years. Mobile phones 40 years, believe it or not. But most of media, as we know it, is very recent. If we condense the history of civilization into 1 year, we've been using media as we know it only for the past couple of hours. And it's being adapted much faster, too. You can see the time here. It took for radio to reach 50 million people. It took 38 years. Television took 13 years, and Facebook only took 2 years. It's accelerated even faster in the last 10, 11 years since 2006, which is when Facebook kind of came on the scene for everybody. The iPhone made the internet more accessible, and the internet made the smartphone more valuable. The Android was launched. Twitter and the Kindle spun off them. So my point is that kids are born speaking this digital language now, and we have to learn it as we go. And we have to be okay with the fact that for many of us, our kids are going to be a step ahead of us when it comes to what these devices are all about. Although there's still a great deal that we can teach them when it comes to the human interaction part of the digital relationships. So what I want to do now is go through what the American Academy of Pediatrics has to say about media use. And some people might find it kind of droll, but you have to remember that the American Academy of Pediatrics is the country's biggest recommender of health guidelines for children. They base their guidelines on research, and there needs to be a lot of research out there for them to make a recommendation. So their recommendations tend to be things like kids shouldn't be in houses with firearms, or pajamas shouldn't be made of flammable material, things that are based on research. So they're not, some of it's kind of common sense, but they've actually updated their media recommendations within the last couple of years, and there's new guidelines now. Up until about 2 years ago, the only guideline from the American Academy of Pediatrics was kids under age 2 shouldn't have any media use, kids over age 2 shouldn't use more than 2 hours a day. They released a new guidelines in October 2016, where they say that children under 18 months should avoid the use of screen media other than video chatting. Children aged 18 to 24 months, if their parents want to introduce digital media, should choose high-quality programming and watch with their kids. Children aged 2 to 5 should limit screen use to 1 hour a day of high-quality programming, and 6 and older should have consistent limits placed on the time spent using media. They say that for families with children of all ages, to make sure that media doesn't take the place of adequate sleep, physical activity, and other behaviors essential to health, to designate media-free times together, like dinner or driving, as well as media-free locations at home, like bedrooms, and have ongoing communication about online citizenship and safety, including treating others with respect both on and offline. That's their general guidelines. Then they break it down into younger kids and older kids. So they have another statement from 2016 called Media and Young Minds, which specifically deals with kids under age 5. And in that, they say that kids under age 2 need hands-on exploration and social interaction with trusted caregivers to develop their cognitive, language, motor, and social-emotional skills. Under age 2, there's limited evidence for using media, even though almost 40% of parents with kids under 2 give their children mobile devices to play with. And this was in 2016. They noted that 80,000 apps are labeled as being educational, with little to no research to support them being educational. I'm sure that number is higher now. I went into the app store, just looked up educational games for kids. These are four of the things that popped up right away. Foot Spa, Milkshake Maker, Kid Shaving Salon, and something just called Newborn Twins, which there's something about that that's funny to me. Like, there's nothing fun about having newborn twins. I get shaving. Shaving, I get it. Nail salon. So they say the biggest factor that facilitates toddlers learning from media starting around a year and a half is to watch with them and reteach what they're seeing, which is so easy to say, but so hard to do. I'm as guilty as anybody else. You put your kids in front of the TV or give them an iPad so that you can get something done, when really we should be sitting with them and watching what they're doing and talking about it. They also note that higher order thinking and executive function skills are best taught through unstructured social play and with parent-child interaction. Then they go through and they talk about the problems with media exposure. Just coming up to the next slide. So they say heavy media use is associated with an increase in the body mass index, which is how we measure for obesity. Slides are stuck now. Let's see if we can figure it out. So heavy media use is associated with an increase in BMI. It's blah. We'll get to it. And the BMI is increased for every hour per week of media consumed. This is made even worse, perfect, because of food advertising. They also note that the presence of devices in the bedroom is associated with decreased sleep duration. We know that infants exposed to media in the evening have significant shorter sleep duration, both because of the excitement that the content triggers and due to suppression of melatonin from the light from the screen. Many studies have shown an association between excessive TV viewing in early childhood and cognitive, language, and social emotional delays, likely due to decreased interaction with parents when the TV is on, and poorer family function in households with high media use. The earlier age of media use onset, greater hours of media use, and non-public broadcasting content are significant predictors of poor executive function in preschoolers. Also, they note that excessive TV viewing is much more likely in infants and toddlers with difficult temperaments, and it's kind of a circular problem because difficult toddlers and preschoolers are given media, which makes them more difficult, so they're given more media. And then the American Academy of Pediatrics concludes with their do's and don'ts. They say that you should choose high-quality programming and apps, and we're going to talk more about how to go about this. You should watch with your child. Video chat is okay. Turn your devices off when not in use, and keep bedrooms, mealtimes, and parent-child playtime screen-free. You should not let babies under 18 months use screens. Let children age 2 to 5 watch more than 1 hour a day. Feel pressure to introduce media early. Use screens to calm, and show fast-paced, distracting, or violent content, or use screens during meals. I want to point out that using screens to calm is a huge pitfall for a lot of parents that we see in the office. People come in, and for a 5-minute visit, as soon as the nurse leaves the room, the phone comes out, the iPad comes out. And most of there are visits where kids get shots, but most of them aren't paying visits, and it only creates problems. So you want to save your distraction for the long plane ride or for like a painful medical procedure and try and avoid using it for just everyday things. They also finish the recommendations with some guidelines for people who work in the industry that deals with media. They say content should be made in consultation with psychologists and educators, be scientifically evaluated before making educational claims. They recommend against any advertising towards children and say that there should be systems to help parents monitor and limit media use. Now we're going to talk a little about the older kid guidelines and some older kid problems. And also Dr. Unger is going to talk about some surprising ways that kids are using media that you may not have thought of. And then we're going to come back to some specific situations that come up.
So as Scott mentioned, I'm a little older, so he gave me the older kids group. So AAP statement for older kids focuses on kids who are between 5 and 18 years of age, discuss the risks and benefits, and some of them are similar to what Scott said in terms of obesity and sleep and school performance, things like that. Much of the media is broadcast media, which is like TV and film, stuff like that, although the patterns of viewing has changed over the years related to this explosion of our mobile phone use. We know that about 25% of kids describe themselves as being constantly connected to the internet. I don't know if that's surprising or not surprising to people. I thought that was sort of a big number, but I guess I'm not really surprised by that. The AAP statement discusses how children need time for sleep, physical activity, and media-free time, similar to what was outlined in the recommendations that Scott talked about. And then the importance of parents and children working together to make an individual, developmentally appropriate family media plan is part of this recommendation. And luckily, they're not just saying to do this without resources. So if there's one thing you take home with you tonight, well, hopefully a few more than one thing, but there is we'll talk about how to develop this very specific family media plan together, parents and children. And it's a very practical resource. In fact, I kind of think most everything we're talking about is practical, common sense. In fact, one of the websites that was one of our major resources is called Common Sense Media. And we're going to show you some surveys, a census that was done by the Common Sense Media group. The younger kids was done in 2017, and the older kids was done a little bit earlier than that. Basically, we know that this is a very prevalent part of our children's lives, and it's something that we have to address together with parents, teachers, industry, policymakers, you know, healthcare providers, and our kids together. So it is mobile media and broadcast media is a universal part of this landscape, and it's not going away. In fact, as Scott said, everything's rapidly increasing as far as how it influences our families. The average time kids spend with mobile devices has tripled since 2013, and tripled from 2011. So the mobile use is increasing. The time that the children are spending on their devices is increasing really fast. Many children use media before bedtime, and many families have TV on all the time. There are about half of the parents report letting their kids use media before bedtime, and about half of parents also have TV on just all the time in the background. Children from lower income homes spend about an hour and a half more time with their media than those from higher income homes. Lower parental education compared to higher parental education also makes a difference, and these differences result from a combination of increasing television use in lower income houses along with decreased use in higher income houses. There's no difference in media use that so far that has been determined by gender or race and ethnicity, although there are some ethnic differences about some of the parental concerns. There's a digital divide that's happening in all different types of families, and it's something, again, that we really need to keep addressing. For the younger children, the amount of time that children spend reading has stayed steady, but many kids under 2 are not read to regularly. And we're learning more and more about the importance of reading to kids early on, starting in infancy, and what it does to their brains. It's an incredibly important thing to do. On average, kids between 0 to 8 spend about a half an hour a day reading or being read to, but only about 43% of kids under 2 are read to on a daily basis. And this is a really amazing statistic, because parents should be educated so that they know it makes a difference in brain development. So there's also cutting-edge technologies like virtual reality, voice-activated assistants, and internet-connected toys that are just getting started, and they have the potential to have really important implications on development, both good and bad. And one of the things that we're going to go over is the incredible positive part of the internet and the media that our children are exposed to. So it's not just a one-sided thing. It's not all bad. It's amazing, but it's something that we need to keep educating our families and changing with the times, and as Scott said, learning from our kids. So it's an interesting balance that we have to look for. So the census for the older kids was from 2015, and we see that teenagers between 13 and 18 watch entertainment media, this means not schoolwork, an average of 6.5 hours a day, and tweens watch about 4.5 hours a day. So this excludes time on homework, but if you add the time that teens and tweens spend listening to music and reading print online, the number goes up to an average of 9 hours a day for teenagers and 6 hours a day for tweens. Not surprisingly, teenage boys spend 56 minutes a day playing video games, and girls only spend about 7 minutes a day. So there's the media diet varies age and gender, and I think that's important to understand when you're making the family media plan that we're going to talk about. Teen girls spend about 40 minutes more per day on social media than boys, and 92% of higher income families have a home laptop versus only 54% of families with lower income. So with all these choices, it's interesting to see that tweens actually prefer watching TV and teens prefer listening to music. I guess that's not that surprising, but it's not even as much social media and spending time creating creative content, but they have their preferences. And a surprisingly low percentage of teens say that social media is their favorite activity. So it's the media choices that children make vary depending on gender, age, and again, it's something that we need to pay particular attention to. Parents are more concerned about media content than time spent using media is what this census is telling us. So media is just a ginormous presence in these families' lives, and we have to continue to focus our attention and education for these families. So it's interesting to see that tweens and teens, they report in this census that parents do care about how long they spend engaged with media, but that they're, as I said, the parents are more concerned about the content. And that being said, about 25% of children say that their parents are unaware of anything about what they're doing on the internet. And teens and tweens do multitask when they're doing homework, but they do not think that that affects their work, and studies have shown that it actually really does. So I would like to just briefly go through the negative effects and also the positive effects, and this is again in the slightly older age group. So we're going to talk about obesity, school problems, school performance, some risk-taking behaviors, mental health, and privacy concerns. And there's actually a DSM diagnosis that's emerging called the Internet Gaming Disorder with specific definitions, and this is something that's sort of on the rise. It still needs some more research to be a full-blown diagnosis, but it's coming. So as far as obesity goes, we know that having a TV in the bedroom increases the number of hours of media use in a very serious way. So as Scott said, the BMI increases for every hour per week of media consumed in two-year-olds. We know that the odds of being overweight were about 5 times greater for children who are 5 to 10 who watch more than 5 hours of television compared to kids who watch only 0 to 2 hours of television. And interestingly, having a TV in the bedroom was an independent risk factor for obesity. So it makes a big difference. And some of the studies we looked at showed that having a TV in the bedroom and watching screens after like 9 o'clock at night is also a significant risk factor for sleep problems and things like that, which we'll talk about. But the good news is that we can make a difference. A study of third and fourth graders showed that reducing TV time, reducing video time, and reducing television viewing during meals, one of my pet peeves, did result in a decrease in the BMI or the weight-to-height relationship. So this is an example of we can make a difference with our education. As far as sleep goes, we know that having a screen or a mobile device in the bedroom is a risk factor for poor sleep. There is an association between the electronics media use before bed, especially after 9 o'clock at night, poor sleep, and depression. So ensuring this adequate sleep is an important part of the family media plan that we'll talk about. Now, that being said, it's really hard to enforce a teenager to not have a computer in their bedroom or screen in their bedroom. So what we talk about is the guidelines, and the guidelines sort of talk about what we want to enforce to do rather than not to do. And then reality sets in, and we'll talk about that. So I'm not saying that you should never have a teenager who's got a screen in the bedroom, because it's going to happen. But you also, if you do have that situation and you trust your child and you set up this, you know, like I said, developmentally appropriate and individualized plan, then it could work. But if you know you have someone who's more at risk, then you might have to go stronger with your, you know, with these recommendations about not having a screen in the bedroom. So it really depends on the family. So I'm not saying that you should never have a screen in the bedroom, because it's going to happen, but you have to know your child. As far as school performance goes, we know that children who spend 2 to 4 hours per day on non-schoolwork media devices have a 23% lower odds of finishing their homework versus children who spend less than 2 hours. Children who spent 4 to 6 hours on non-schoolwork media devices had a 49% lower odds of finishing their homework. So it's an important factor. So there's a similar relationship between increasing digital exposure and decreasing childhood flourishing. Childhood flourishing is described in these recommendations about children who care about doing well, complete their tasks, show interest in learning new things, and staying calm when challenged. So that's what we want our children to do, and empower them to make good decisions. And the media diet is something that could influence that, again, positive and negatively, but we need to make sure we're establishing these healthy guidelines. So just, we're going to talk about some more recommendations, but I'm just breaking this down, a few little quick tips for these problems that we talked about: obesity, sleep, and school performance. Be aware of your child's media habits. Be aware of your own media habits. Being a good role model is obviously really important, just like it is for eating behaviors and other things. Encourage regular routines for sleep, studying, physical activity, meals. Be active as a family during the day. Promote interesting and varied activities that will help your kids do that. Monitor screen time, especially at night. Avoid TV placements in the bedroom, depending on your child. Create a sleep and study environment that's incredibly supportive and organized. And recognize that, interestingly, teens need more sleep, not less. We have to make sure we include time for nature hikes and family activities like that. As far as risk-taking behaviors, studies show that exposure to alcohol, tobacco, and risky sexual behaviors in traditional media like TV and movies is linked to initiation of these behaviors earlier. Digital and social media influences have similar influences to the broadcast media. And restrictions that protect children from unhealthy television advertisements are there, but there's exposure through social media that we can't control, because social media has no boundaries, essentially, sort of boundaries, but not really. So cyberbullying, a definition of cyberbullying is an aggressive intentional act or behavior that's carried out by a group or an individual using electronic forms of contact repeatedly and over time against a victim who cannot easily defend him or herself. So it's interesting to think about the differences between cyberbullying and traditional bullying, both of which can be incredibly problematic, both of which we need to pay attention in school. In fact, the first question I ask a family in my office when they're telling me about that, I said, how does your school support you? So it's really important, which I'm sure you guys understand. So the differences between cyberbullying and traditional, number one, with the cyberbullying, victims do not necessarily know who the bully is or why they're being targeted. And hurtful actions can reach the victim any time of day. There's no safe haven, essentially. And bullying messages can spread like wildfire with cyberbullying. The similarities are that both can lead to short and long-term negative social, academic, and health consequences. They both can lead to higher levels of depression and decreased self-esteem for both the bullies and the victims. And victims do have a higher risk of suicidal ideation for both kinds of bullying. As far as sexting goes, just to get the definition out here, it's electronic transmission of nude or semi-nude images, as well as sexually explicit text messages. So first of all, the facts. About 12% of kids have sent a text, of teens. There's a higher frequency in the LGBTQ environment. There's more sex partners, greater odds of depression, impulsivity, and substance abuse among teens who do sext. Studies show that this is related to risky sexual behaviors. That's not surprising. A study of 55 urban youth showed that about 70% of girls and 82% of boys received a sext. That's a lot. 52% would be comfortable talking with their doctor about sexting. I can tell you that before Scott and I started to do our research about this, I was asking way less questions about the media concerns of my kids, of our patients, and we're trying to educate our colleagues so that we are asking more important questions, because kids do want to talk about it, and parents depend on their healthcare providers to also provide resources. So we need to pay attention and be able to give some guidance that will help promote safety, wellness, all that. As far as mental health goes, there's actually a U-shaped relationship between adolescents and internet use and mental health problems. We know that there's a positive association between increased social media use and increased depression. We know that passive social media use, which is one-way communication, is more associated with a decline in well-being and mental health concerns compared to active, which is like two-way, like having a conversation with someone. So it's besides the number of hours spent on media, what's very important to understand is how our children are spending their time on social media. As I mentioned, there is a new diagnosis that's part of the DSM-5. It's called the Internet Gaming Disorder, which is defined as persistent and recurrent use of the internet to engage in games leading to clinically significant impairment or distress. And you can see the criteria here, which I don't have to go through, but basically this is labeled as a condition for further study. So it's not an official DSM disorder, but it's something that the American Psychiatric Association is doing additional research on. And again, as Scott said, these were not concerns of ours even just a couple of years ago. As far as tips go for these things that we've talked about, we need, and again, common sense, that's, you know, we're sort of like a broken record, but it's important to engage in early discussion about friendships, relationships, how to keep them healthy to maintain open communication, educate children about appropriate online and offline behaviors, help children identify trusted and supportive adults, collaborate with schools and children to encourage victims to report cyberbullying and make sure there's resources for them, collaborate with school nurses and healthcare providers to help with these resources. And it's important for everyone to know the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act guidelines so that we know, you know, when we need to support our children. In fact, when we were at dinner at Scott's house, his daughter, how old is Monica?
7.
Said, what does this have to do with being a pediatrician? And, it was an interesting discussion. So as far as privacy policies, this is a resource for you. And again, if you don't have a handout, it sounds like it's going to be ending up on your school website, so you'll be able to get it there. You can also contact us at our office. But the privacy policies for the most popular social media sites are listed here, and I think it's important to become familiar with them. Now, no matter what kind of guidelines, you know, and we can talk some about that, parental controls are on there. Believe me, your children are going to get around them. So it's important to still understand what you can. So the good news is there's obviously... Scott, I made a joke.
First time.
There's a lot of positive effects of media also. Exposure to new ideas, current events, learning experiences, facilitating community participation, connections near and far, I don't know, I think you said this, but like FaceTiming with grandparents or whatever is always okay no matter what age your child is, and that's amazing. One other very exciting use of the internet is use of support networks for certain health conditions and chronic conditions that promote health promotion. However, it's always important to understand that these very groups that can be really helpful can also seek delay in traditional treatment, give misinformation, provide unhealthy influences, and maybe hostile and negative communication. That's where the eyes in the back of your head with parenting is what's important. And again, it's kind of like well, okay, this is more old-fashioned, but if you think about should you read your child's diary or not, you probably shouldn't read your child's diary, but if you have a high-risk person, then you should. And it's part of the art of parenting is to figure out when you need to look further and, you know their passwords and, you know, monitor what they're doing closer or farther away. So, okay, what can we do? And I think it's important to understand we're talking about healthcare providers. Now, I wanted to include this because I want you to know the kinds of questions that ideally we're going to be asking your kids. What can parents do? What can educators do? Educators can come to these lectures. That's amazing. One concept, so as far as healthcare providers, about 16% of pediatricians ask about media use. And I can tell you for sure, before we started thinking about this more, I might ask a few questions, but now I know a little bit more about what to ask. And 29% of parents report relying on their pediatrician for advice about broadcast and social media. So what can we do as healthcare providers to help families with their resources? Well, the thing that I would really like for you guys to go home and do with your children is look at, this is again powered from the American Academy of Pediatrics. If you go to a website that's healthychildren.org, there is a family media use plan that you are supposed to do with your children. Now, you could do it for younger kids, you could do it for older kids. This plan promotes adherence to the guidelines that Scott went over for healthy media use, adequate physical activity, healthy nutrition, things like that. So our goal is to promote training and media literacy for the entire family and to screen for children who have problematic use and provide resources. So the questions that I think we should be asking are things like this. How many hours do you spend in front of a screen? Do you wish that you spent more time or less time on screens? Have you ever messaged photos or texts or anything that you regretted? Can you think of a friend who was harmed by spending time online? It's always good to get to the friend avenue. That's like how I ask about, do you smoke cigarettes? Do you have friends who smoke cigarettes? And then you go in. How do you feel after playing video games? Do you read for fun? What types of books do you read? Just to get an idea of how they're spending their time and how important it is to do the healthy activities as well. So these are resources that we want you to know about. Healthychildren.org, which is backed by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Common Sense Media, that when we were doing our research, it came up over and over and over again. And you can check out that resource that helps you sort of navigate the media world of your children, even like pick movies that are okay and things like that. And there's a few others that you'll be able to take home with you. As far as parenting strategies, the general guidelines set limits at every age from like prenatally on, why not? Establish and teach safe behaviors online and offline that apply to their world. Understand social media and digital etiquette and privacy safeguards, and recognize that online interaction should follow the same social guidelines as face-to-face encounters. It's kind of like a lifelong discussion of the golden rule. Treat people how you want to be treated and be responsible. Discuss monitoring, proactively engage in digital media use together. In fact, I was reading something that was from healthychildren.org today, and the author who has a new book about this said it's like Michael Pollan's advice from Omnivore's Dilemma, or I'm not sure which book it was, but he said, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And so this author said, it's like that. Enjoy screens, not too much, mostly together. So I like that one. Let your children teach you. That's a really important thing, and I think it's kind of a great way to empower them. Warn children about the importance of social media privacy settings. Really important to establish media-free zones. I can't tell you how hard it is to convince some families that they should not have the television on during mealtimes. It's something that, even though you might think you don't need to educate families about it, from the very beginning you do. And establish this family media plan. And what the media plan does, and I'm going to hopefully let you guys do it yourself. My kids are 26 and 28 years. I pretended they were 26 and 28 months, and I went on and did it myself. And I will tell you, it's pretty common sense, but I still think it's helpful to do it. You know, again, the benefit is establishing this conversation. So what it does is, and you can see this laundry list, it really helps you go through the guidelines that Scott talked about for your family in a very individual way. Most importantly, to communicate these guidelines to your family and your caregivers and develop it together. So, Scott is going to then go on to say now what we really should do.
So then, like all that being said, things that come up in the office, like this comes up not just with media, but with anything, that's what you say to do, that's what the guidelines say to do. What am I really supposed to do? Like the American Academy of Pediatrics says babies should be in a room with their parents for the entire first year. Great, how am I really supposed to get? So I wanna go through some of the things that come up with media that even though we know the guidelines, how do you really handle it? But remember first that everything in parenting, every interaction that you have is a teachable moment. There's successes and failures, and both of them are opportunities for learning and growth. So you're gonna mess up, and it's okay. We all mess up. So the biggest question initially is how much free time is really okay? How are you supposed to keep a 6-month-old from ever seeing a screen? It's impossible if you ever want to enjoy a screen for yourself. So are you really going to hurt them if you're watching a baseball game or watching, and they're in the room in their rock and play or something? Probably not. If you put them in front of it for 6 hours as a way to take their attention off of you, that's probably going to harm them. But if it's just on in the background and you want to enjoy a show for a half an hour at night, it's probably not going to hurt them. But when you do watch media, you want to make sure that you use it as a way to talk to and bond with your baby in small amounts. Like if you want to show your kid your iPad or your computer, do something useful with it. Show them pictures. Talk about what they're seeing. Point out relatives or friends. Point out objects. Don't just sit them there and let them watch it unlimited. And remember that video chatting is okay. A lot of studies have shown that babies can tell the difference between video chat and other kinds of video. And it can be a good way to bond long distance, and it does not count towards screen time. Screen loss tantrums, which is a big deal for toddlers, should be handled like any other tantrum, ignoring and distracting. And the best way you can avoid massive meltdowns with kids and phones is to not give them the phones in the first place. Give them real toys. Give them books or blocks or dolls, something that's not a $500 machine that's much easier to take away. So that's your very little kids. As you get into the preschool years, we get more into like, how are you not going to rot your kid's brain? What am I supposed to let them watch now that I can give them an hour of screen time? There's so much out there, and so much of it is just garbage. So let's talk about preschoolers. Preschool-age kids develop opinions, and they have ways to express themselves. They have longer attention spans, and they can tell stories. They like imitating other people, but they can also be emotionally labile. They want to have friends. They understand friendship involves sympathy and conflict resolution. They can use devices. They can turn on phones and tablets. They can use remotes and trackpads. But they cannot connect what they're seeing to real life. It's really important, like with anything else, to watch with them at this age. This is a good time to start teaching a concept of media literacy, which is about teaching kids how to think about the information that they're seeing. So if you're going to have your kid watch a show, even though it's painful to watch some of these kid shows, watch it with them and just go through the exercise of asking, what is this about? What did you hear and what did you see that make you think that that's what it was about? Even with commercials, did you see anybody you recognized in that commercial? What did it tell you to do? And you should do this even when you're reading books. What happened in the story? What did you think about it? If you're going to do games online, like iPad games, what happened when you pushed that button? What did the thing on the screen do? And this is also a good time to start recognizing what appropriate content should do. So appropriate content should help preschoolers build vocabulary, count, and learn about the world. It should be concrete and not abstract, and it should be there to educate and not entertain primarily. It should model positive, healthy, nonviolent behavior. It should encourage acceptance and respect of different people. The parents should be involved. There should be frequent automatic stops in appropriate content. Like, so it shouldn't just be something you can put your kid on and let them use it for an hour at a time. I put some examples on the slide of things that the American Academy of Pediatrics likes. People a lot of times will say that they use it to help their kids read, and I think reading is like potty training. It's kids do it when they want to do it, and you could use every trick in the book, and if they don't want to do it, they're not going to do it. So don't feel like using an app is going to teach your child how to read. As we get into the school years, we got to start having kids get more independent. And one of the biggest things that they're going to do in the school age is to learn about how to search for and evaluate information. Things that you can do to help with this is to show fake information when you see it. So show fake information when you see it. This is a website, the one on top there, dhmo.org, dihydromonoxide.org. If you go to it, it's like, dihydromonoxide is bad, it's poisoning the world. You can even donate money to people who are helping to stop the dihydromonoxide industry. It looks like a real website, but it's for water. It's about water. And it's a fake website, and it's made for the purpose of teaching kids about fake websites. And there are a lot of things like that. So you can consider setting safe filters and safe searches. It's a touchy area. People ask a lot about, how do I monitor what my school-age kid's doing? The best way to do it is to watch what they're doing. You can put all the filters and blockers on that you want. They're going to get around it. I don't think there's any kid, even 7, 8-year-olds can figure out how to get around blocking software. This is a really good area to involve your teachers and librarians. I cannot help my middle school kids here do their school reports anymore because I just don't know how to source things properly. If I say, look on Wikipedia, they look at me like I told them to, it's not a good look that they give me. I told them, you can't look on Wikipedia, it's like McDonald's. I say, Google something, they can't Google something. But the school here especially does a really good job of teaching them not only how to evaluate information, but how to make me feel bad about not knowing how to do it. In terms of getting them into searching, I put some websites up here that are a little bit less likely to give you scary results than Google. Kidrix and Kiddle and kidsearch.com. So this is also a good time to start talking about rules with your school age and how you expect them to behave when they're online. They should follow the family rules about where and when to use the internet. Be polite, kind, and respectful. Understand website rules and know how to flag inappropriate behavior. Recognize red flags like having to give names and addresses, knowing not to share their name, their school name, their personal information, or their passwords. Never to open messages or pictures. I put on here just some ways to protect your own privacy, which I think is more helpful if you have younger kids. The enable guided access is a way to open up something on your phone, give it to your kid, and they can't get out of it and go to anything else. And then you can set restrictions, which is a way to keep them from going into things that you don't want them to see. And also, you can use setting restrictions to restrict content by age rating, to block websites, and to hide explicit language. We actually had some fun at work testing the explicit language thing, setting a filter today. Urban Dictionary is a fun website to go. So as they get into the tween and teen years, this is where you have to send them off and start doing things on their own. Tweens care about the news, they want to be informed, but they're skeptical of what they read online. So you want to listen to what they're hearing and help them follow up what they're seeing by helping them track down sources, researching authors and news organizations. This is a good age to talk about advertising and clickbait, like different types of online advertising, chatbots and embedded marketing and viral videos. I was surprised that even my 11-year-old knows what most of these things are. And tell them to explain to them what the concept of clickbait is, so they're not.
And also, one of our colleagues might not have known what clickbait was.
Right, one of our colleagues we found out yesterday did not know what clickbait is. Pornography is a tough. They're going to find it accidentally or on purpose. They're going to find it, so it's a good idea to talk about it before they see it. Not in too much detail, but you can explain what it is in an age-appropriate way. Tell tweens that it's natural to be curious. Make sure that they know that you're available to talk to them about any subject, and it's never a good idea to punish a kid if you find them, especially the first time you see them seeing something inappropriate, because you want them to know that they can talk to you about it. Explain to them that pornography typically presents the extremes of relationships and that people are paid actors. And also, like anything in the teen and tween years, you've got to be a good role model. Parents who complain in the office about their kids texting all the time are invariably texting on their phone when they're telling me that. So you've got to watch what you do. The other thing my wife was saying, you should tell people what you do that you find helpful. And I think that if I had to pick one thing to tell that I think is the most helpful in creating a healthy family dynamic and keeping kids emotionally healthy, have I told you? What would you say it is? One thing. If you just say one thing.
Family meals.
Family meals, absolutely. If you can just sit down for half an hour.
We did not discuss that.
We did not talk about that. Yeah, it's something that you said. If you can sit down for a half an hour with no devices, with your kids, talk to them about their day, And this is not just me talking because my kids are a mess, but we have family meals. And if you can do that, if you can make time, that little bit of time, it doesn't have to be every day. It makes such a huge difference to get those devices, get everything away just for a little bit of time.
In fact, family meals, the studies show that family meals from the beginning help reduce teenage risk-taking behavior. So it's real.
Yeah. And as we also get into the teen and tween years, social media use starts way earlier than I initially thought that it did. There are 5 million Facebook users under the age of 13. That's crazy to me. 24% of the 80% of female Pinterest users are 8 to 14 years old. 35% of tweens have set Snapchat. The survey we talked about earlier showed that even though they're using it a lot, social media is not what tweens and teens prefer to be doing online. They might be doing it, they probably are doing it, because everybody else is and they don't want to miss out. The reality is that most kids start developing online relationships around age 8, usually through virtual worlds like Club Penguin. By age 10, they've gone on to multiplayer games, your Minecraft, and sharing the digital creations on YouTube. By age 13, millions of kids have created accounts on, like I said, Facebook and other social media sites. The essential safety and responsibility guidelines for middle school age kids in social media, follow the rules. Most social media sites have a minimum age of 13 for both legal and safety and privacy reasons. And even though I see so many kids who have social media under 13, they really shouldn't have it. Tell your kids and show your kids that you think before you post. And if anybody's friends with me on Facebook, I do think before I post. I just think that things are funny.
Which is kind of hard to believe.
So remind them that everything can be seen by a vast, invisible audience. Every family has different rules, but I think it's at least initially a good idea to have kids access to what, or parents access to what their kids are doing online. You don't give your kids keys to the car and say drive. You have to teach them how to do it, or somebody has to teach them how to do it. Make sure the kids set their privacy settings. Even though they're not foolproof, they can be helpful. And make sure that they know that kindness counts. You can consider, if you are going to do social media, starting on your own phone, approving and following their followers, limiting where they can use it. They can only use it if they're in the kitchen or they're in the living room, not in their bedroom. And knowing their passwords, which is a personal decision. I think it's a good idea to know your kids' passwords. But we'll talk about that in a second when we get to cell phones. When to get a phone? Biggest question people ask. I think the average age now for kids to get phones is somewhere in the 10 and a half range. And that's certainly what I see, at least around River Forest. Everybody's got an opinion. So many articles written. There's very little research. And there's lots of pros and cons to getting it at different ages. But that being said, everything I read, the right answer is 7. No, the right answer is not 7. There is no right age to get a phone. Surprisingly, like with anything else, it depends on your kid. Keep in mind that once you open that Pandora's box, you can't close it. You're not just giving them a phone. You're giving them all of the information in the world, good and bad. There's a book that I read called The Boogeyman Exists, and he's in your child's back pocket. And I almost wouldn't believe it, except it was a published book that had research behind it. They'd surveyed 70,000 kids in 2015 and 16 and found that sexting on average starts in 5th grade. Pornography consumption starts around age 8. Pornography addiction at age 11. We know from Common Sense Media surveys, 2/3 of parents say their kids are addicted to their smartphone, and 1/4 say that they argue with their child on the phone about the phone on a daily basis. That being said, there's no right age. Things you want to think about, your child's independence level. If they can't get their stuff ready for school in the morning on time, they probably shouldn't have a phone. Do they need a phone? Number one answer when I ask parents, why did you get your kid a phone? What's the number one answer? Why did you get your kid a phone? What's that? So you keep track of them. Do you need an iPhone 10 to do it, an iPhone 8 to do it? Can you do it with a Nokia flip phone? So I get the idea of needing to keep track, but they don't need an iPhone to do that. They don't need all the other access. They should be able to understand privacy, and they should be able to be responsible. So some considerations, like I said, getting a dumb phone. There's a website I like called cyberwise.org, which has some good digital literacy programming. It is a paid website, but it's got programs on there that kids and parents can do on ways to safely use a phone. This idea of having a contract, I kind of like and dislike. I see friends post a lot on Facebook. If you're gonna do a contract for your phone, what I don't like is the ones that says, like, I'm giving you a phone because I'm a great parent. You're gonna do this, 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 and this, and if you don't do it, I'm taking it away. You're gonna lose it if you don't do this. You don't do your homework, you can see it on test. I think if you're gonna give them a contract, have some give to it too. Say, like, also, if you use it responsibly, I will give you more leeway with it. I'll let you use, have more time with it. I'm not going to necessarily watch everything you do if you can show that you're responsible. So I think if you want to use a contract, it's okay, but keep in mind, you don't want to just beat into them what you're going to do if they do one thing wrong. Parental monitoring apps and taking away the phone are things that every parent has a different opinion on. I think in general, although I'm not 100% sure why, there was just a big article in the Wall Street Journal that I couldn't get because I don't subscribe to it, but about that you shouldn't take your phone away from kids as discipline. And I don't quite get that. I think I can get it for like a high schooler who might have different needs. I take my middle school kid's phone away when he's got problems. I mean, I think it's an effective, discipline involves rewards and consequences. The reward is you can go on your phone, the consequence is you didn't get it. That's my personal opinion. That being said, there is a lot of research, or not research, but articles out there saying that you shouldn't take it away. Then I think we're running low on time. We decided not to go over these. We have some information on ways you can monitor.
Yeah.
We're not experts in how to, like, the specific software and the specific programs to use. We just wanted to get across, like, general concepts. But we have some information on about specific things.
But we started with a positive quote, and we're going to end with a positive quote. This is by a scientist from California named B.J. Fogg, who, by the way, one of his students in like 2009 to 2010 decided that it was important for people to be able to send their emotions to people, like so you could take a sunset and send it some way. He predicted that this would be important to do to someone who wasn't in a sunny place, and the process was called Send the Sunshine, and that eventually became Instagram. So that was one of this guy's students. But so B.J. Fogg, who was a social scientist at Stanford, in 2008 said, "I believe we humans are fundamentally good. I believe that for the most part, we will create vehicles for mass interpersonal persuasion that will benefit society, that will enhance education, improve health, and help to bridge national and cultural divides. This democratization of persuasion will lead to far better outcomes than those achieved when persuasion is controlled by a few powerful groups. The power and potential of mass interpersonal persuasion gives me hope for the future." So it's important to understand that the combination of computers and internet and social behavior, we can make it work together, but we need to really help our families, our providers, our educators work together. So, thank you very much.
It's all right, I'm going first. It's been decided. So we created a presentation for you tonight from the perspective of digital learning in our district. And I'm going to kick it off. Does that work?
Sure. Forward.
Wrong button. So we're going to look at this tonight from the lens of we're all here, and we're here, and we have a shared responsibility to make digital learning in District 90 a success. So from the perspective of from students, from our perspective as staff, and also families. So we together are partners, and without all of us together, our district won't be successful. And we outlined some key areas. Of course, there are a lot more responsibilities, but just the key ones that we highlight. So for one, District 90, we need to design engaging instruction with the use of technology. Our students are using technology academically for content creation and thoughtful consumption. And from the family perspective, you know, checking in, questioning, and looking. And also, obviously, I'll plug the Create and Stick to a Family Media Plan. And Kevin?
So I get to do the granddaddy documents of the whole thing. You're going to have this presentation. It's on our website. We'll share this with you. But there's all links to what sort of the guiding principles, guiding documents, policies that apply to the use of technology in the district. The first and foremost being the acceptable use policy, which all staff, all students, and parents sign for what you can do on the internet, what you're doing with the network, what's allowed, what's not allowed. Just last year, the board adopted an instructional technology student data privacy. In my personal opinion, that is probably the piece of using technology that is the most critical going forward. You know, we give kids, hand kids iPads for them to use because that's just the current device. But knowing privacy resources, knowing how your information is used or can be used is absolutely critical. What's important for you guys to know is that we vet every single app that goes onto all of the student iPads against a system by Educational Frameworks is the name of the company. They use the same back end as Common Sense Media to vet all of the apps and give it a score and give us a legal description of who can and can't use it. You know, saying that, you know, kids under the age of 13 shouldn't be on Facebook, well, that's right there in Facebook's policy. If you're under 13, you cannot have an account. But we heard the numbers of how many kids under the age of 13 have that. So that privacy policy is designed to let you know all of the different legalese that are involved, the COPPA and the private PI, publicly personally identifiable information. Absolutely critical stuff that, unfortunately, America tends to be much further behind Europe on. There's a huge change coming in May, the right to be forgotten, and things, all of these new technologies and new laws that have gone into place in Europe that we're going to play catch-up on, that are going to be implementing and impacting the way we use technology going forward. That's a very important. I would really highly recommend you guys go and check that one out. It's a good overview of what the current laws are and what we do in the district to abide by those laws. The technology lending agreement is something that every 5th through 8th grade student and parent sign. That speaks specifically to the iPad that we have given the students to use, what can and can't be done on that iPad, what's expected behavior, you know, what happens and who's responsible when things get damaged. It's kind of just the little legalese document that says this is what you're we've handed you and this is how it's expected to be used. The last one is a link to a Parent Tech Tips website that is part of the district website that we've had for several years. That does some of what was described tonight and also has some additional tips and resources that you can go to see, you know, other places where you can get information.
So back to what Cindy said about our roles. When we think about District 90, it's us as instructional technology specialists and how we're supporting teachers and how introducing them to the types of technology that they can be using with school with the students for learning. It's behind the scenes with Mr. Martin with that safe online business and just making sure that everything is vetted and students are protected. It's also teaching digital citizenship. So that's teaching students about the responsibilities and opportunities of being online, which includes being safe but is not just limited to. So everything that we're talking about here is with our district device. So when we talk about digital citizenship and we're doing lessons, it's at the elementary school, in the library class, in middle school, it's embedded in lessons. It's also explicitly taught when they first come in fifth grade through the tech class. And there's a nice capstone project with the eighth grade students about that media literacy, which was talked about. We also have a subcommittee now that's district-wide and looking at how we're teaching digital citizenship and what kind of gaps we might have and making sure that we're aligned with our language. But all of the conversations that we're having at the district level are about district devices, so this is a friendly reminder that students shouldn't be on their personal devices when they're in school.
Okay, so students in our district really have many opportunities to do creative things on the iPad. They are they're writing, publishing, explaining how they solve the problem. They're taking pictures, they're telling a story, they're filming, they're creating presentations, often collaboratively. They're coding, it goes on and on. And they, these are original works that they are making with their device. when they are reading or doing research, more of like the consuming type things that, that we know we can use devices for, they're using materials that the teacher has curated, or they're using databases that our librarians have showed them how to use. Or they are on their device using, you know, answering questions or looking at a video clip that they are accessing because we have purchased some curriculum that supports Common Core State Standards. So these are different ways that students use devices in the classroom. And if you are ever on Twitter and you search for the hashtag D90Learns, you will see other examples of what's going on in the classroom, both with technology and without. So that's some of the things that are happening in the classroom with devices.
That was a helpful slide, especially with the less than 5% of what they're doing it with their personal devices was content creation. So a main goal of them using the district devices in school is content creation. So there's that divide there. So back to the shared responsibilities for success. When we say checking in, that means that this is a school device. It's not private, and so it's perfectly okay and expected. We tell the children that your parents are going to want to see what you're doing and show off all of these great things that you're creating and these interesting things that you're reading and putting it in your research papers. So feel free to ask them what they're doing for homework and to look at their screens. If you are at the elementary, if you have a student in elementary, they're using Seesaw at both of the schools, and that's a nice window into the classroom and a conversation starter. If you're helping your middle school child at home and they can't quite remember what they have to do, we just sent out your parent login information for Schoology. And that is our new learning management system that that teachers are using for workflow. So resources that they're going to need, that thoughtful consumption of the online spaces that they need students to go to are going to be there. And it'll clearly say what is due and when it is due, and the materials are there also. Just to support what the pediatrician said, that you're creating these spaces that are going to be helping them be productive students when they're at home. So doing homework in public rooms, the living room, kitchen, not in bedrooms. If you have any questions, I want to mention that Parent Tech Tips site again. There's a lot of information there and places to check, but if you can't find it, please email the teacher directly and ask a question if it's about that class. If it's something technical, you're welcome to email anybody on the tech support, and I've definitely had my share of being on the phone and helping a parent set up how they can see what their student is doing, so we're happy to do that. We also want to support that family media plan. So if you make any changes, please do so to the home Wi-Fi and not to the student device. Sometimes it affects them when they come to school and they're not able to do the classwork because it's blocked them out of a certain site that we need them to use. So all of that information is not only on the pediatrician's site, but it's also on our tech tip site. And like we said, purposefully shorter, because you guys had to sit for so long. So I think we open it up to the town hall.
Yeah, this is a QR code that it's an exit survey, so we want to get more feedback from you about what you thought of tonight, what additional opportunities would be of value to you, but also at this point want to open it up to any questions you might have for us or for the doctors who have been very kind to come to us tonight.
She'll come home and she'll say, I need to get on Google Docs, or I need to get on this, or I need to get on some website to finish my homework. And this is at 7 o'clock at night, and the project is due tomorrow because it's a, you know, something that was assigned today, and it was just a little something they're supposed to do. And I can't check in effectively with the teacher, and there's not one place where I can go for each class to know what's required throughout the year and what's not required. It's not necessarily on Weebly or on a newsletter, or if the newsletter was sent out once and it's gone and I don't have it printed out or I don't have it saved on my phone, could there be a way to streamline what resources each of the classrooms are using so the parents can check that rather than having to check in with the teachers each time?
Yeah, second and fourth grade, I don't have a great answer for you at this point. They've adopted Seesaw as a way to do that lens into the classroom. Something along those lines is what we're looking at for the K-4s. Roosevelt, we've adopted Schoology as an LMS, and that should become your one-stop shop for your point of entry. The teacher may tell a student to go to 25 different sites, which is part of the lesson, but in terms of you as a parent having an idea of what actually is being asked of the student, Schoology at the middle school is definitely what you're going to be using. At the K-4s, there is not, at this point, a concrete LMS. Seesaw has some of those capabilities, and we're really sort of in a pilot year of getting to use that. But I would honestly reach out, send an email, or reach out to your classroom teachers and say, you know, are you using a Weebly site? Are you using a classroom site? Is there some other place where I should be going to look for that info, right?
Yeah, but that's good feedback to share.
Awesome.
That's something that we can bring back to our schools and figure out how we can make it easier and to support our parent partnership. So thank you.
Hi, I have a middle schooler, high schooler next year, and elementary. And I was curious, we do a lot of home with family plans, and moving forward, I think it's wonderful all the things you're doing with curriculum. But I do see a lot of holes since technology is new with free time at lunch. I mean, I'm a designer, so sometimes I'm online. Little girls are liking my posts for work, and I'm like, wait, they're at school, you know? And I'm wondering, as a school-wide, are you revisiting maybe certain times where it's like iPads off? I know they do homework at lunchtime, but I feel like that's such a valuable time of day for interaction, you know, for connecting with people. And I know some kids like to do their homework, but have you ever considered shutting down and letting the kids just have recess? So.
Keep looking over here.
Yeah, I keep looking. I'm looking at you too.
It's so new.
It's tricky at lunchtime because there are many kids who are actually doing work, and it's hard to monitor 600 kids and say, okay, everybody's off their devices when there's actually very productive things happening. We have meetings with the teacher team meetings every day. And we kind of do it on a case-by-case basis. We kind of know the kids who are out there a little too much. We steer them away. And that's the best thing to do right now, making blanket expectations. We can't do it. And it's really tricky.
I know years ago.
I guess my point was, I know it says no iPhone use. They're all using them. And, you know, when they go to cross-country, kids are all on the phone, and I understand it's so hard to control, but can we make stronger policies that so maybe they put their phone away?
I have yet to see one, and I'm really sneaky. I'm not saying kids don't go to their lockers in between class or something and get out there and do something, but compared to years prior, it is, we're in a lockdown mode. Teachers see it, we are all over it, everyone will attest to that. I don't see it. I'm sure they're doing it, but they're not able to do it at, you know, free reign.
Oh, and please don't take it that way,
no.
But I do think it's here, and, you know, I think it's constantly changing, and I'm just curious if you're
If anyone else here has a middle school student or doesn't have a middle school student, the way recess works is that the students sign up for a room that they're going to go to. And so sometimes there's clubs, like there's chorus or animation club. And then sometimes there's spaces like study hall or, specific game rooms, strategic games. So that's definitely something that there's an adult then who leads that space. And so while we might not have a blanket rule for no devices or yes, devices are okay, we have definitely empowered the teachers who are running specific recess rooms to say, if you want everyone to be learning cooperative play through board games, it's very much okay for you to say, in this room, you are not allowed to bring your iPad. And so don't want anyone to walk away feeling like at recess everyone is all on their devices. And even in the rooms with where devices are okay, like I run Animation Club, for example, I am very much following those guidelines of what are you making? Let's all put it on the big screen. Everybody else put their iPad down because so-and-so spent an hour drawing this, you know, amazing thing. So there is some structure. It's not entirely unstructured, but thank you for that feedback.
When I question it, I know wonderful things are happening. I'm just maybe
doesn't
think more.
Yes. So you're not the first one. There's definitely been people that say, like, wait, this is video hall room. Why is everybody bringing in an iPad? We're collectively watching this one movie to talk about it. And so they've decided it might have been an iPad-friendly room before, but now when you come to video hall, you're not allowed to bring your iPad.
Question for the pediatricians. So reading is great, but using an iPad too much is not good. So at the end of the day, just make sure they're books. Actual physical, good old-fashioned books for them to read?
Yeah. I mean, there is a good amount of research out there that shows that kids learn better, that I've seen at least, that kids learn better from paper than they do from Kindle, which is not a screen like an iPad, but, so yeah, I mean, it's...
So don't be too green.
Right.
Well, the other thing that we said was to start that really early. So I think if you start those patterns early, it's sort of like with the family meals, if you try to do that when you have like a 13-year-old, it's not going to work very well. So it's, you know, role modeling and starting from the early, early time.
Those are the questions.
I do want to add that I have two little kids too. One is a preschooler and one is a kindergartner. And we think of your slide that says, now, what do we really do? I mean, there's some times where I am going to be reading something from a screen, but I consciously still pay to have a paper newspaper delivered to my house every day so that my children are seeing that I'm also reading the newspaper. And what was interesting the other day is I'm sorry, I brought it to the dinner table, and I was reading the paper, and my son put his hand over the words and over the picture. So I think it's about finding that balance. And I know the question wasn't directed to me; it was directed to pediatricians. So if we think about what can we really do, yes, definitely get print in your home, and in the kids' hands. But you know, it's gonna happen that we're modeling that we read things on screens too.
I had a follow-up also for our doctors. Question about how you can decide upon the age appropriateness of your child when to allow them to use the screen unsupervised. Like, what are some good guidelines you might give about a child maybe being ready to do that and to play on their own at what age?
I think, at least for my own kids, I run them through like scenarios, like show me what is it you want to see? What would you do if a message popped up? You know, how would you answer that? And then once we go through that, I let them use it and just kind of around and kind of keep an eye across the room and then let them kind of go more on their own. And then they do make, like, I still check, I don't know how people, parents feel like this, but I still go through I only have one who has a cell phone, only my 13-year-old, and I still look at his texts. And he says there's all sorts of things that come up in there, and it's tough how you deal with that, but it's just about having an open mind and not being judgmental and getting angry because he says something horrible or one of his friends says something horrible. So. Is there a
kid? Sorry to be a second question person. when kids are older, because Dr. Under knows how old my kids are, use of media, is there any effect at that point? It's negative.
That's a good question. You know, when I was looking at some of the mental health studies and things like that, it was for older kids, so I think there's information about, like, some, you know, depression and mental health concerns, and for older kids and less so even for our younger kids. That research was a bit more for older kids. So I know there is for mental health concerns. As far as the obesity thing, you know, we were really focusing on young kids and teens, and I don't really know for older kids what the associations are. So I'm not really sure about the, you know, when you're getting on like college and stuff like that. But, you know, we do know as far as like sedentary activity or, you know, quality of sleep. I mean, I imagine it's pretty similar, but I'm not sure if the specific research.
My question is about at what age can a child safely play with other players online?
I think kind of what Scott said, you have to know your child. There's, I know like under 13, they're not going to be able to go directly on, you know, these social media sites. It just depends on your child. It's like, you know, when can your child take a taxi cab? It's not really a specific age. And with parenting, they're really difficult decisions because what's right for your family is not right for another, and you're going to hear about that. I think it depends on knowing your child and, like what Scott said, building in your checkpoints and your feedback and checking in with them even when you think you don't have to, but you probably really do. You know, like I said, well, what you said about knowing your passwords of your kids, I think it's a good idea. Will you use it all the time? No, but you know, they need to know that you're doing that and that you can do that. So I don't have a specific age.
Very.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you're here. You guys did such a good job.
Thank you. Thanks for having us, you guys.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'd like to make an announcement. We have extra copies of the handouts of the presentation. I'm going to put them on the table outside where you signed in. So as you leave, you can pick one up.
And we'd like to thank everyone for coming. Before you head out the door, a couple of, I think, recognitions are certainly due. If you could take a moment and appreciate certainly both Dr. Unger and Dr. Goldstein.
Need my signatures.
So you need a motion to
careful.
We're not sure if it'll hear.
This concludes this evening's committee on the whole meeting. And can I have a motion to adjourn?
All in favor?
Aye.